Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the second in a series whose first part appeared in episode 12, the non-fiction writer and memoirist Francis Spufford speaks with Carol Angier about his adventures in Russian economics and Christian apologetics and his gradual journey towards pure fiction writing.
Francis, your whole life that we've heard about so far has been very literary, but actually you are far from a two cultures divided man, and your books are amazing on science and on maths, lots of maths, and on philosophy. So in your writing, you combine science and literature in really a remarkable way, a bit like my own subject, Primo Levi. And that starts here in The Child That Books Built, I think, because you bring in a lot of experimental evidence. Piaget, you talk about Bettelheim, Chomsky, Shannon, who wrote a book on mathematical theory of communication, and so on. And you also have scientific imagery that you use, like you say, about fairy tale, for example, that it's like a flow chart of an algorithm. So I am just interested in, where does this scientific interest and learning come from?
Well, it doesn't come from me having a genuinely scientific aptitude. It's more a window that my nose is pressed to, interestedly. There's a bit of science in my family history. Both my mother's parents were working research chemists. But I didn't inherit an ability genuinely to thrive in maths or in science or in economics. I am the proud possessor of a physics A-level of enormous badness because I wanted to stick with it because I was interested, and I learned from that actually my interest is not the same thing as an aptitude. Interestingly, philosophy is fascinating to me in exactly the same way because I don't belong there. The air in there is too abstract and rarefied for me to breathe comfortably. I'm much more murky and concrete and applied. But I'm fascinated by what it would be like to be at home in those places. I can see many points of contact and similarity. In fact, what baffles me is the extent to which other people don't see that science is a rich and potent and nearby source of metaphors. I mean, obviously, a fairy tale resembles the flowchart of an algorithm. Oh, pay attention.
So moving on to Red Plenty. This seems to me your most ambitious mix, right, of fiction and non-fiction. And you tell us that it started out as a more conventional history of the Russian dream of plenty via mathematical planning in the early 1960s. So I have several questions about this. First of all, what drew you to this subject? That's to say, Russia and mathematical economics.
Plenty, to begin with. Not the red kind, but just plenty in general. I found myself very interested through the kind of dot-com boom and things by how the dream of abundance works in people's imaginations. And then I was also thinking about how extraordinarily sharply the world has changed in my lifetime, because I was 27 when the Soviet Union ceased to exist. So I got used to the world beforehand, and I have some sense of just how different things are now, and how, without the horrible old Soviet Union, how much the West is different too. And I wanted to get back inside the world before the change and show not just how strange then looks from the perspective of now, but also how strange now looks from the perspective of then.
Now, the second question is, you know, why did you move from that conventional history to this half, or even more than half, I would say, fictionalized version? Because many characters are pure fiction. Many characters are real but fictionalized. So we have now Khrushchev. We've got the sort of lead economist, mathematical economist, Kantorovich. So here we have your most fictional effort so far, as you've said. So I'm just wondering what really moved you to this. I mean, in The Child That Books Built, you say that you preferred fiction as a child very much, very much. And you give us all sorts of reasons about the as it were, perfection of it, the sealed-inness of it, the fact that it was comprehensible. It was a perfect shape. You could see the pattern. You could see the way through. And that made it distinct from reality and also from nonfiction, which has this really appalling connection to reality, which makes it messy and not shapeable enough. So is that why? Why did you feel so strongly that you wanted to fictionalize this so much?
Not because I wanted to get back to a childhood preference for fiction as more perfect and more separate. I'm glad to say that my feelings have changed slightly since I was 10 about this, and I now actually prefer the messy and the multiple and the untidy. My imagination is much more strongly drawn to it. With Red Plenty, there was a practical factor as well there. I had begun thinking that I was going to do something very documentary about this piece of Soviet history that was intriguing me. So I set off naively towards Russia with tape recorder, thinking that I would follow the same technique I'd followed in Backroom Boys, where I interviewed British engineers, and I would just sit. The right Russians were still alive at that point. I would just sit them down with my tape recorder and they'd tell me what was what, and then I'd work with the documents. And that's not what Russian history has left Russians willing to do. Russians do not blab their deepest secrets if you turn up with a tape recorder and go, "Hello, I'm a stranger. Tell me what you really thought in 1961. They will get you hospitably drunk. They will give you nice things to eat. They will show you the pictures on their walls. They will make it clear that if you'd like to get to know them for about 5 years or so, the question of what they felt in 1961 might then come up. So I was blocked. I couldn't get to the expressive middle of the story I wanted to tell there. So I actually had no choice but to deduce it imaginatively from the outside and start trying to concoct something. I chose to get even more fictional, but I was also driven by necessity towards getting more fictional. I wanted to do justice to mess, in fact. I wanted to talk not just about an idea, but about what happens when an idea gets dragged through an unsuspecting world. And in the Soviet case, ideas are uniquely powerful and often very destructive indeed, and produce enormous ironic ripples. Ideas themselves, too tidy. I wanted an idea in lives, in experience. And this partly goes back to my dissatisfaction with the way I'd ended up doing kind of tacitly fictional non-fiction in Backroom Boys. I wanted something which showed its workings properly. With a novel, you know when you're inside a character's viewpoint. There isn't a kind of synthetic nobody's viewpoint in particular. Experience gets owned. It's that person who's feeling this thing. And I wanted to be doing that. I wanted the kind of the interplay of different characters looking over the same territory. And I wanted lots of people, because if you're going to write something that's sort of a Russian novel, then you have to have a large cast.
So you explain to us that, for example, you invent some dialogue. I mean, that's perfectly reasonable. You change sometimes the times, you know, something might have been said earlier or done earlier or later. That all seems perfectly reasonable. But there is some fictionalization of real people. For example, Khrushchev, you know, where we get inside Khrushchev's head in a novelistic kind of way, exactly what he's thinking and feeling, actually very, very effectively. So I want to know, first of all, was that based on anything?
It's based on Tolstoy doing Napoleon and Grossman doing Stalin, which feels as if there's a well-blazed trail there. You're kind of allowed, and there's something about the great and the powerful which makes them imaginative public property in the first place, so I think that's relatively unworrying. Also, they tend to be very documented, so the least likely ones of Khrushchev's thoughts are often the best documented. Once he was in retirement, he talked into a tape recorder for hour after hour after hour, and most of the stuff ended up being edited. So the last words from him in the book, when he goes, "What kind of shit is this when you have to keep people in chains? What kind of socialism do you call that then?" which sounds altogether too neat, is an actual Khrushchev utterance in miserable retirement. So that is actually a relatively easy category. I worried much more about the middle ground of the book. Easy when you just invent people from scratch. Easy when you do the great and the well-documented. But when you're doing people who are sort of half-real, in the sense they're standing where real people stood, but you're taking the license to invent, that seems much more troubling. I worried my way through that considerably, not just on ethical grounds, but kind of on aesthetic grounds as well, because I'm not a Russian. I'm writing from far outside that society, and the opportunities for getting things wrong in terms of mood and perception, of behaving like a historical novelist who just hasn't got some obvious thing, was terrible, lined with pitfalls. The nicest review Red Plenty has got, as far as I'm concerned, from this point of view, was by a formidable Russian critic called Lev Danilkin, who described it as, quote, crude but not ridiculous. And I thought, yes, I am crude but not ridiculous doing Russia in the 1960s. I'd like to have that on a sort of laminated certificate I could put over my desk.
That was a lovely story. So the middle characters are the ones that you worried about. But I also thought, for example, certain events, like the Great Massacre.
The Novocherkassk Massacre.
Yes.
Which is documented, the sequence of events is exactly as it happened, though, of course, I had to take an opinion on why it happened, and then, unlike someone writing history, where you put your opinion as a theory, my opinion just solidified into a sequence of events. That's troubling. I had to invent a viewpoint character to see it and then to kind of integrate it into the rest of the book. And needless to say, I am well over the bounds of my own experience, not having been ever involved in a massacre. And yeah, now you worry that you're not giving tragic events their tragic weight. You worry that you're being impertinent. You worry that you're being ridiculous. You worry that you're making cheaply eager use of desperately heavy material. I ask myself, well, would you be willing to do this with the Holocaust or a bit of the Holocaust? And the answer is probably no, which does suggest that there's something about how relatively unknown the Novocherkassk massacre is, which seems to make it more imaginatively open to me. And I worry about that too, because why should my relative ignorance seem to give me relatively smaller or larger permission to make use for my own fictional purposes of other people's tragic experience? That does not compute. Nevertheless, it seems to be the case, so I did it.
Well, these are deep and profound problems. I'm sure we could talk about them forever, but we better not. So shall we move on to the last book, Unapologetic, your, as I called it, polemical defence of your Christian belief, or of Christian belief in general, perhaps. And, of course, the main point you make is that it's not just about belief. It's brilliantly argued, and it makes me want to argue back, because, as you might easily guess, perhaps I am one of the millions of atheists whom you have to deal with these days. So tell me if I'm wrong here, that the core of your thesis is that what's important about Christian belief is not a truth claim about the existence of God, or a doctrine, or anything that we would call believing in something, you know, that X is so, but it's a set of emotions, of natural emotions, feeling loved, feeling forgiven, feeling mercy, and so on. And that belief in God answers human need for these feelings. And questioning some kind of truth claim is beside the point, or at least partly beside the point. So have I got the kind of general point right?
I'd want to modify it a bit. It's not saying we should look away from truth claims because I don't myself think the truth claims are true. I do, in fact, believe in that stuff. It's that I don't know that stuff, and I'm not terribly interested in treating it as a form of knowledge, because it wasn't as a form of knowledge that it made sense to me, or that I think it has a recognisable place, even in a kind of mostly post-religious culture. I want us to look away from the truth claims because I think it's more interesting and more substantive to talk about the emotions by which belief lives day by day. And I also think that it's the thing which is most in danger of becoming invisible as it recedes from most people's direct experience, at least in our society. It was only supposed to begin as a polemic. That is to say, it was supposed to lay about itself as a polemic enough to clear a space to then do something non-polemical. I'm sure that the paranoia of the believer in the age of successful atheism plays a part here, but my perception is certainly that there hasn't been much public room to talk in patient and ordinary ways about what religion feels like. It's as if the gap has been closed for that. So I wanted to kind of push it open a bit. Polemic is not something I've done before as a writer. It was quite fun. It too brought its own uneases. There's something very seductive about being extremely rude about people, which I'm not sure is a very good thing for the long run, and I don't plan to do it again in those terms. I appeared at a book festival with Richard Dawkins. I was on at 7, he was on at 8. I got a polite pattering of applause, he got a massive standing ovation, and I was rude about The God Delusion in a way I've certainly never been about another author's book at a book festival. And I bought him a large glass of white wine afterwards because I felt so awful about the breach of basic writerly good manners. Also, it felt as if it took a bit of nerve to come out as a churchgoer at this particular moment in time, in this particular place. And being aggressive and swearing a bit can be a help when doing something you have to nerve yourself up to do.
Well, certainly there is a burden of anger in it. I mean, you are very rude. You're very rude about Philip Pullman. You're rude about A.C. Grayling. So there's some anger in there, which is very liberating and a breath of wind.
It was fun to do. Yeah, there was a burden of anger. I would like to distinguish between some of those people there. Richard Dawkins, I revere, he said, choosing the word because he knows it'll be most annoying. As a science writer, I think he's astonishingly good when he's writing about evolutionary biology, and I've learned a lot from him, and I would wish to be only rude to the part of him which insists on holding forth about religion. A.C. Grayling hadn't found much to respect there, happy to be just generally rude. Philip Pullman, a great object of admiration for me. I meant one targeted rude joke about the good man Jesus and the scoundrel Christ, but I would be very happy to take up cudgels for his Dark Materials anytime, anywhere. I think he's a marvellous writer, and I certainly don't wish to be just rude about Philip Pullman in general.
No. And the whole question about polemic is secondary, really. I mean, the main thing is your thesis about this core of what it is to be Christian, and which is to have a set of feelings, and these feelings are natural, and these feelings are somehow appropriate. And that is what Christian belief is essentially about.
I'm not indifferent to whether the truth claims that religion makes are true. It's that I don't think that they actually can be resolved. I think it's resting on something which of its nature can't be settled as true or not. And that in that case, if you're dealing with something whose truth you can't and won't be able to assess here and now, it then makes sense to say, well, is this kind? Is this dignified? Is this immediately valuable in human terms? But I'd like to pick up one thing you said in the question about the naturalness. I think it's natural to have religious feelings, and almost all humans do in one way or another, however we label them. I don't think that the content of Christian belief, which is what I respond to, is itself particularly natural. What I find powerful about it is the extent to which it goes against good order and biological common sense and things as well. What is powerful for me about Christianity is that it isn't a system of achievable virtue. It's a system of impossible demands whose consequence is that it lets you see everybody with kind pessimism as one kind of inevitable failure or another. Christianity offers me a kind of brotherhood and sisterhood of screwing up, which I find far more attractive than I would any invitation to join the ranks of the virtuous. I do not belong in the ranks of the virtuous, and Christianity lets me be a curious sinner, which is something I can do with no effort at all.
All right, one more question. There is one thing that you say in the book, well, there may be more than one thing, but which I do find extremely persuasive, and I think that I would have been interested to hear you say more about it. And that is that you had an experience. You also go on having experiences, perhaps, but you talk about an initial important experience that you had. And it's on the basis of that that you feel not only able, but perhaps, you know, constrained to have this religious faith. I haven't had such an experience. And that may just be something that hasn't happened to me, that I lack. And of course, we know that, say, someone who is blind believes sighted persons when they say there's a visual world.
Yep.
And they should do. So could you tell us about that experience?
The experience in question is an experience of the presence of God. in order to make that visible in the book, in fact, I took several different experiences and wove them together with the inevitable sense of alarm about whether I was counterfeiting what I was trying to represent. But if you don't even try to represent such experiences, then there is something hopelessly missing in your account of why faith is compelling for you. And books have to represent the objects they talk about. It's a question of getting people to feel, at least while they're reading, what it is that is there to be felt rather than understood. I think a lot of people have varieties of those feelings, but they label them extremely differently. And I have no trouble with them being labelled extremely differently. I'm not saying that it's a universal. I'm not saying either that it's a sense some people have got. I would resist the idea that it was like being able to see when other people are blind. Possibly it's a bit more like being musical when other people aren't so musical, but I don't know. Or maybe it's having a particular conformation of your temporal lobe. But it seems to me that it has more to do with good literary things, to do with being willing to stay in uncertainty, to have faith in doubt, to be able to stick with some complicated and ambiguous set of sensations and trust it enough, live with it enough to make the sense out of it that you can. I see faith as having a lot to do with negative capability, with being in doubt without trying to resolve it, without trying to flatten it into some positive and provable statement. I don't think that people who haven't felt it are deficient, or that they're missing something, or that I've got a special antenna in my head that allows me to report on the truth, capitalised, about the universe. But on the other hand, I can't give no weight to something felt. If I believe in the rest of emotional experience, why would I suddenly decide to become so sceptical as to be utterly silent about that bit of experience? If nothing else, it's very interesting trying to describe it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Francis. Can you just tell us very briefly about, are you working on something now, and what is it?
I'm writing a novel. No footnotes, no supporting ground of fact. It's intensely nerve-wracking.
Wonderful. You're doing what you want to do.
Yes.
We wish you the best of luck, and we wait for it eagerly, Francis. Thank you. That was Francis Spufford, author of I May Be Some Time, The Child That Books Built, Backroom Boys, Read Plenty, Unapologetic, and To Come, a new novel. Thank you, Francis.
That was Francis Spufford in conversation with Carol Angier. You can find out more about Francis on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 17, which was recorded by Carol Angier and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 18, we have the poet Robin Bolam on roots and their importance in writing, and the Bulgarian writer Capka Kasabova on writing and exile. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.